Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Naturopathic Futures Conversations. I am super excited to invite and have a deep and meaningful conversation with one of my favorite people who shares my love of research, shares my love of art, and we get into really great conversations philosophically and otherwise, and I think it's going to be a fun way of exploring Dr. Moira's perspectives on the naturopathic profession and where we have been, where we're headed, and get into a bit more about the behind the scenes, because so many of us know Dr. Moira as the vaginal expert. Really, let's be truthful, all things vaginal microbiome and intimate ecology. And I am super excited to dive deep on where she's come from and where she thinks our profession's going. So good to have you. We get to hang out a bit more frequently because I have known you for a few years now. And one of my favorite things is knowing that you have this beautiful crossover when it comes to the naturopathic profession and your love of the arts and other things. How did you end up getting into the naturopathic profession in the first place, when you have such an eclectic love of lots of different topics?
Yeah, there's probably a few things right at the beginning of my story, because I went into university to be a naturopath straight from year 12. So it was there was a few other choices on the table, but naturopathy at that point is what I wanted to do. But it had been much earlier where in high school, when they have those sorts of conversations about what are you going to do and where do you go from here? And I wasn't, and still very heavily into art and with painters and medium. And my mother at the time, bless her, said, "Moira, you don't really see any rich artists." And not that I want to be rich, but at the same time, I didn't want to struggle. And she said, "You can go and do something else and do art on the side," which certainly has some truth to it, although I'm sure you would agree we don't get to do as much of that as potentially we want to in different phases in our lives as well. And whilst I was on the verge of a few different things, because thankfully I found I have some talents in a few different areas, I was in the process of, I need to pull together an art folio to go to Hobart, because I grew up in Tasmania, to go to Tas Uni, which has quite a fantastic art school. And when you get to that point where you're submitting applications, I'd also, through various health issues and the fact that in high school when you get to go and do work experience, I chose to go to Gould's and do some work experience there.
This is just a fairy tale for many of us. Straight out of high school, figured it out, wanted to do naturopathy, straight into the Gould's work experience. Yeah. Wow.
Which I really loved. And there was some that was very formative. And I'd been to see herbalists at that point, for I was one of those kids with acne, which on an introvert, very socially disabling, to have that sort of physical barrier as well. And so we'd gone and seen Chinese. So that introduction to that was very young for me as well. And so I had, at that point, when you do those sorts of applications, put in to do naturopathy through Southern Cross as my primary choice, and had done the entrance essay, and then had secondary choices with Tas Uni, no longer wanting to be an artist. That is still very strong in my mind, what my mother said. But I went and also applied to be a marine biologist, which I got accepted into as well. And on the day that I was at Tas Uni enrolling in marine biology, my mother rang to say, "We just got the acceptance letter for Southern Cross University." And so
sliding doors. I didn't know it was that close.
Yeah. So unenrolled on the spot and pretty much walked away. And then within a 2-week period had moved to Lismore, northern New South Wales, from Bobart as a 17-year-old with not really any out of home experience, and jumped straight into that.
Wow. Wow. I didn't know that was that sliding doors moment of literally the same day. That's incredible.
Yes. Yeah.
My dad had the same notion. I said, "I want to do a Bachelor of Arts degree." And he said, "Do you know what you'll get at the end of that?" And I was so excited because I thought my dad knew everything. And he said, "Would you like fries with that? You'll have the ability to say, 'Would you like fries with that?' And it won't make any money. It won't do." And I think there's something really interesting about that, that our parents go, "Oh, it's not a job that's going to be financially rewarding." And you and I have had conversations about this before. I just wanted, because you brought it up, I was like, it's so true. We also got told in our qualifications during our time as students that one in five of you will actually make it. And it's really difficult and it's really hard to make a living out of this, let alone actually be rewarded. What's your take on that now?
It is one of those things. I'm very dogmatic in that once I decide to do something, that's what I'm doing and I will see it to completion. So even though in 20 odd years of practice, there have been seasons where it's not been what I wanted it to be, my decision was and my identity is that's what I am and that's what I'm doing and I will make it work. But I have also very similar recollections and also some positive ones. I remember being told at university by Sue Evans that this is a degree for self-starters. And at that point, I was like, what does that mean? And obviously, it means you are in there doing it, creating it, making it happen. This isn't one where you get employment very easily. You are the main event. And I mean, that also stuck with me and it is a positive thing in my mind because it is, I knew from the beginning that this was all up to me and what I was doing. And whilst it took me a time to be more financially stable or happy with where I was with it, there hasn't really ever been any time where I felt destitute through that career either, and that there was always opportunity to go and find. But it is a very interesting, I think we're at a point now where there's much more ability to put yourself out there, and I see that there is potentially more success than there was for people who graduated back in the early 2000s or in the 90s in general, because you were very much where you were landed. That was your market and that's how you got yourself out there. There was letterbox drops and there was...
Oh, the good old letterbox drops. I was just thinking that as soon as you said it. I was, oh, yeah, letterbox drops were way more difficult than writing a post on social media.
Definitely. Folding 2,000 flyers, those sorts of things are really important marketing at that point in history. But very hard. And so you had to be also be very determined to keep it going. But it is a beautiful career in the sense that you can reimagine it and do different things. And now when I look back on what I have done with it, there's some really fantastic things. There's some really parts where I was also, gosh, I just can't. I just want to be lazy or do nothing. I'm very much a sloth. The couch is a big part of my life at the moment. But it is, there is lots of ways that you can reinvent yourself. And I think that there's not many careers or pathways that have that and still connect you on so many really amazing principles and moments of joy as well.
I couldn't agree more. Prior to being a naturopath, I was cancer research and that was it. If somebody was a researcher, they, especially in the laboratory, they got in at a certain level, then they did a project and they published and it was very linear. And different seasons of researchers, laboratory researchers' lives don't necessarily take into account so many opportunities for the perfect sidetrack. Or if we have a river of life, there's no little creeks that you can go and explore and come back in again. Whereas I feel like our career pathway has so many different parts to it. And depending on whether we are single, want to travel, feel that we need stability and security, we have kids or we come back from after having kids. There's so many different seasons of our lives and so many different things that take our interest along the way. Can you tell us a few of the highlights that you've had that you probably didn't think as a 17-year-old going into your naturopathic degree that you would have had the opportunity to do?
Yeah, I think probably the first thing is, as a 17-year-old popping into a naturopathic degree, I don't know if I had any concept of what that meant when I popped out the other side initially. And so when I did pop out the other side, I was very thankful to have people around me that were happy to jump into business and mentor me and project me in that right direction. So initially I went straight into private practice, full-time commercial premises within Valley Heads on the Gold Coast. And that was somewhat difficult, little revenue at that point. We built wall, literally. I was a plasterer one day and we built this clinic. And then I remember having very little sleep and we had our first patient booked in. And I don't know how I didn't fall asleep in that chair. Thankfully, I don't think I did, which is horrific to think about now. So private practice at that point. And then I had a moment. I was obviously very young when I graduated, 21, with little world experience. And I had that epiphany, was like, oh gosh, I need to travel. Otherwise I'm here doing this, which is fine. It's a wonderful career. But at the same time, it wasn't where I needed to be. And weirdly, I'd seen at that point, and she's like, no, you need to be over in the UK. And I was like, oh, okay. And so then that played on my mind. And so then I made that decision again, very suddenly. I remember telling my mum at the time, I was like, oh, I've booked to go to the UK. This is what we're doing, within a very short amount of weeks. And so I saw my part of the practice at that time and headed over to the UK via Thailand. Thailand was important for me because I had been doing a lot of supplement the naturopathic part of the practice, or to keep the people coming back. I had found that I was really great at walking on people and using manipulation, but using my whole body weight to do that. And so part of me was like, oh, I probably should.
Oh, Dr. Laura, tiny. It makes sense. That's the type of space that you would take up physicality weight for massage.
All of 5 foot tall. So I ended up in Thailand and spent 3 months there. And in that 3 months, did a Thai massage because that really interests me. And Eastern philosophy really interested me. And I was looking for a more energetic modality to integrate into how I was functioning as a naturopath at that time. So did, which was a wonderful course of just massaging and being massaged every day for weeks on end. And then spent some more time traveling around that area and had some really wonderful experiences with people up in the hills of Thailand and looking at medicinal plants and things like that. And then I found myself in the UK and working at Neal's Yard Apothecary and also teaching for CNM at the time as well within their Bristol campus.
Amazing.
Which was terrifying at that point, again, because I hadn't had much experience
public speaking.
And at that time, very much more afraid of speaking than I am now. But I found that it was a really great experience. And working within the apothecaries too. So I was in the Covent Garden one, but I was also what they called a mobile assistant. So I was traveling around all of the Neal's Yards in the Greater London area on days when they needed staff cover. So I also got to see different areas and the boroughs and work that way. But the CNM then and the Neal's Yard really developed my confidence in talking to people, which I was not great at, in having quickly available information and being able to prescribe on the spot, but also making sure I knew what I was talking about. And I was confident in what I was saying and where that sat into, in terms of accuracy, I guess, was sort of one of those points as well for me.
I think a lot of people downplay the apothecary role or the health food shop role or the retail on the floor kind of role. And exactly what you were describing, those skills are so important and transferable to think quickly, to be able to find what's actually going on and quickly identify what could be helpful in the moment. That acute prescribing is a real skill, and to engage with the public in general is quite scary. Many of us know that when we are just writing a social media post and freaking out that someone's going to cancel us, it's the same kind of thing when we're on the floor and we're trying to say something, like you're saying, that's accurate, that isn't red flagged, that might not cause a problem straight away, and to think on your feet like that. I think a lot of people downplay that skill, but to have it so early on in your career, it's such a great skill to start off with.
Yeah, definitely. And it then allowed me eventually, very silly of me, I followed a man back to Australia, who is not my husband. And at that point, so I left all of that and came back to Australia. And then was, now do I go back into practice or do I need to be thinking about future at this point and what that meant financially? So then I found work in a pharmacy. So I was then put into a pharmacy role as the head naturopath. And again, those skills are important, and it was a great networking experience. And from there, I jumped over to managing food shops on the Gold Coast and over-the-counter dispensary. An apothecary, and at that point went back into private practice. I was co-running on my day off from being the manager, with having a whole day of clinic, and was bumbling along, not with great client consistency, but was there if I needed it. I could book it out if I didn't want to be there. And I was at that point, which took me a long time to realize I didn't want to do, was also offering my Saturday mornings up for clinic as well. But it kept me in there. At that point, I was mid-20s. The person I followed back was not the forever person. But by the time I got to 28 and had that monumental, oh, crap, this needs to change again, I then crashed my life in that relationship, enrolled myself to do a master's of acupuncture. Within a very short amount of time, met the person that is now my husband, worked harder on the fact that it needs to be a better career for me. I would like to expand that. It was a really interesting time for me at that point.
Yeah, there's something right at the beginning that depending on the season of your life, there's so many other opportunities, and whether it's heartbreak, loss, or invitation to a new chapter, and so many different things to study. I don't think medicos get to do this kind of thing where we go, Thai massage, that sounds amazing. I'll just go acupuncture, I'll add that to my tool belt. Yeah. It's a real gift to be able to sit in that beautiful gray zone and lean into whether it's the more to the white side, more to the dark side, more to, and get that texture of gray that we particularly want in our careers at that point in time. Yeah.
Really, I feel like I'm one of those little elves in a computer game going around collecting the little things to put in my bag. Because one day you need those skills. Different patients require different applications. And sometimes when I'm talking to people, I'm totally in the Chinese medicine energetics of it. And others, I'm super medical, straight down the line. This is what we're doing and this is how we're approaching it. And I think that's important to be able to integrate and pick up on that person's needs and how you might introduce that to them as well. So yeah, skill collecting is an important and privilege, I think, for our profession as well.
And you collected a rather large, I call it the floppy hat. If we were wandering around little computer games and you came across a big floppy hat, you collected one last year. Tell us about how you stepped up from a master's in acupuncture to end up being a PhD.
Yeah, so I joke with my husband that about every 10 years I have an epiphany that I should be studying, but I've been told I'm not allowed to do that again in the next 10 years. I did the Masters of Acupuncture. I went off, then did a bit of acupuncture, obviously. I ended up in China as part of that degree and then came back, and I finished my degree. My husband at that time had been bugging me, I need to get married. I'm like, no, I said yes to an engagement, not to a marriage at this point. And then within pretty much a few weeks of finishing or submitting my final assignment, I was like, okay, let's just book this. And so I rang up, booked a wedding, told my husband we're getting married in about a month. And then it all fell into place, lovely. And then we had a child, etc. And so at that point, I had when I came back to Australia as well, I jumped back into some teaching. And so at one point I was teaching for the SAFE Academy, teaching homeopathy for them. And pharmacology. And then ended up at Endeavour teaching pathophysiology, and had been then ticking along as a lecturer / clinician at that point were my main two things I was doing in a week. And so I had gone off for maternity leave and then come back into lecturing quite early, within 4 months of having a baby, because we needed financial income, obviously. And then within being at Endeavour for a number of years, I was like, I met some really interesting people who had PhDs in my life. Maybe I need to do that. What can I do? And it's co-occurred with me falling into vaginal health or realizing clinically that I had a lot of gaps in that knowledge base. And when I'd thrown myself into understanding that knowledge base, it was really inspiring and was something that I thought, oh, I could do something good here. And so when I met these inspiring people, I was like, maybe I could bring those two things together. And so I found myself then, how do I make myself appropriate on paper that my master's, which was course-based, then creates a pathway into PhD, because it's not always a linear pathway. As naturopaths too, I want to do burn study, although thankfully there are more secure pathways now. And at that time I was like, this is what I'm doing. And so I found through the beautiful Amy Steele, she connected me with my supervisor, Evelyn Tiralonga, and we had lunch where we'd never met each other before. And I was like, this is what I want to do. And she's like, I think I want to do that too. And so we ended up from there, she helped me pull together an application. And on that application, one of the things that we can do as people with coursework, higher degrees, is make ourselves prettier on paper. And so publication can be part of that. So I True. This is where I think I jumped into your mentoring, is how do I create this income stream that makes my family comfortable with me stepping away from the senior lecturer role at Endeavour at that time and replace that income stream? Because it was a significant part of how our family stayed alive.
Yeah, and having stable income is one of those things that a lot of practitioners with the self-starter scenario, and having somebody who runs a business means that it's not going to necessarily be as stable as a wage. And how do we replace a wage when we're so used to having a wage, especially when we're providing for our family, our mortgages and all that kind of stuff, if we really do want to dive deep into a new degree or a new, I think it's a really great question. I don't think you're the first or the last to actually consider how to set that up and how that can actually be successful so that you can do both. And I think that's the thing. Everyone thinks, oh, I can do one or the other. I can do lecturing and have the wage, or I can do the postgraduate, or I can just focus on my business. When in actual fact, we have this beautiful blessing of being able to mix a whole bunch of those together.
Yeah, definitely. As long as you get that nervous system support, I think that to know your limitations around that. But it
gets of Withania.
Yeah, definitely. It is interesting because some people feel like they're a failure to spread themselves into multiple areas. When I think, you know, I'm a clinician, but I don't want to be a full-time clinician. I think that would break me in some ways. And so to find that lovely balance where there might be paid work and there might be self-employment, or there might be some other ways that your income is diverse and comes to you, is a really important part of finding that balance as well. And so at that point, I have a husband who's a very big worrier around finance sometimes. And so he was like, are you sure we're going to be okay? And I'm like, we're going to be fine. Just trust it. We're going to get there. And so part of that, when I finally, with you, we were like, I remember you saying to me, is this what you really want? Because I was totally procrastinating on getting this publication written. And I'm sure it was what I really wanted. And then there was the building of the original course that I did, which was part of that income replacement. And by the time I got the acceptance letter and the news as well that I had a scholarship stipend, which is part of food, that's all it really covers. By the time I got that, I was much more confident that I could walk away from this role of being a senior lecturer and be comfortable in our, not thinking we were going to lose our house, essentially. And so it was a really wonderful transformation, I think, for both me and my partner to have that confidence and to realize what hard work can turn into within the profession as well. So then I jumped into being a PhD student.
Yeah, and sharing your wisdom whilst learning that wisdom, creating a foundation of education for yourself where you were coming in with new information and all of that research that you were exploring, as well as everything that you already had under your belt of two decades worth of stuff, became the basis of the first iteration of Itomedicology and has helped so many practitioners. And therefore, the ripple effect of so many women and those who identify as women with so much more that we weren't talking about 5 years and a decade ago. It's amazing.
Yeah, which sometimes when I reflect on that, I'm like, why weren't we talking about this? Because obviously now it's all I talk about. Yeah. And it's so prevalent and disruptive to people's lives. So such a privilege to think about that ripple and where it's been and where it can go in the future as well.
Amazing. I love that you've touched on so many different parts of your career and how they've spanned globally, how they've spanned multiple different subject areas. And I was talking to Kira Sutherland in another episode, and we were talking about the science and the sacred. And I think that there is such a space for both. And even when we don't necessarily seek that out, it's something that creates a really cool balance when it comes to our profession and what we're interested in.
Yeah.
Speaking more on the philosophical side of things, one of my favorite things about the naturopathic profession is we're based on principles, and you have both the Eastern and the Western experience of principles-based medicine. If you were going to pick a naturopathic principle that you most align with, what would be one of those naturopathic principles?
That's a hard question, because obviously there are things that permeate what we do in general. I was going to say first, you know, because I think one of the things that has evolved in my awareness as a practitioner over time is just how traumatized people are and how that has changed how I interact with people as well. Initially, that principle was, oh, I wouldn't do anything to harm anyone. This is, I've thought about my protocol entirely, but now it is about even how I present information or what comments my brain says, but I don't say out loud. It's such a nuanced principle, really. An important one that is interpreted on multiple levels for a human and how they operate, I think.
And it's really evolved, especially over the past 5 to 10 years in the inclusivity realm that we all play in. Whether it's LGBTQIA+, whether it's neurodiverse affirming, whether it's so many more nuances to the people that we're seeing that are actually coming to the forefront, rather than it being all of these hidden parts of these people's lives, we're actually in a really privileged place to be able to sit with somebody and share those parts of themselves. And it's really important how I'm the same. How our facial features are in a moment can be interpreted in a way. The words that we say, the directives that we imply. Yeah, I think it's very nuanced. And from that perspective, we don't just have us in the present. We also have us on social media platforms. And you've had all sorts of experiences, even using the terminology of vagina or vulva online, that there are other people's filters that are experiencing these in different ways, right?
Yeah, totally. It's huge. And my core as a human is I don't want to harm anyone. That's just, what's going on here? Can't we just be nice? And it took me a long time. It was a conscious decision to change the way I talked to be inclusive. And it was a practice. And you have to practice those things like any other skill. And so that comes through in social media and it comes through in how I talk to people and the way I ask a question. And it also gives me the courage sometimes to pose those questions to people. And I think if you're talking about something like neurodiversity, oh gosh, have you considered that you might be XYZ? And then often people are like, oh, I have been thinking about it. Yes. And then the conversation leads to how will you do best if I present information to you? Are you going to be overwhelmed if I suggest this, or if I have too much text in your treatment plan, or are you somebody that needs all the background details and the philosophy and the theory and the science in your plan? Or are you just, I want 5 dot points, off we go. And I think that creates that safety as well. And people are now in our clinics telling us about horrible experiences with other health practitioners. And it is testament to the work that we put in as clinicians and the great variety or scope of practice that we can have in terms of, on a human. We have beautiful resources that we can tap into to build those bridges and take our practice into where we are historically as well. So it's a really fantastic thing to be sitting there with people and have those conversations and to feel like a safe container for them to come in and express the safety in my practice of talking about genitourinary health, but also to explore that they have health anxieties and to make you've not triggered that by having a comment or a discussion around a bacteria, for example. So it's really important that we really think about that principle in so many ways.
That's a great one. I love that. I love that you picked that one. It's a rarity. I like it. And I like the nuance there too. You've identified a really big challenge that we have. We have so many different people that come to see us. And you also identified that things evolve, the way in which we practice evolves. And that's a challenge. We've got to keep on top of all of these nuances, ways of being, so that we are living by the principles. What do you see is actually the biggest challenge in naturopathy?
A lot of my personal interaction is online with the world in general, but my personal interaction with the profession outside of live events is through an online interface. And sometimes I see things that sadden me. But I wonder whether it is because the interface is written and online and open to interpretation as well. Because that sometimes around things that are conceptually true in multiple different ways, there is infighting or very black and white opinions on things that are grey or that could both be truth for different people in different spaces. And so I think that as a profession, That's an important thing to recognize as well, and have some, again, level of, as a human being, kind and coming at it from a point of view of potentially all truths are true for every people, and that there are nuances in why somebody has come to that, and that there are also, for us people out there, where that is the right approach for them as well. I find that's a very interesting thing going on in our profession, but I also acknowledge that the online world has a lot to offer for us as well, in that interconnection is greater than ever before. When we first graduated, was my business partner, and that was it. And getting to a conference was sometimes not an option unless you got a free ticket from your rep. There was lots of things that created barriers there.
There were so many barriers to entry. It was just, and they felt inconceivable. And I like what you're saying, that even though the barriers to entry have lowered, there is a level of curiosity, acceptance, understanding, kindness that is also seemingly lowered as well, because of some, I think what you're describing is one side of the coin and then the flip side of the coin. And without each side of that coin, it's a difficult one.
Yeah. And hopefully we find a way through that is more coming together than is inviting. But I also think, as a human, sometimes I remove myself from online spaces that make me cringe internally, or are just not the way that my brain functions. But that's how the algorithm works anyway.
It's another skill, right? If we're going through this game of life and we're playing it for how it is, another skill is to figure out what is acceptable in your world and what's not, and how to use the snooze button on certain particular topics, or how to turn things off, or how to turn your notifications off. I think there are nuanced skills in playing in the online space that, we can create boundaries around. And it's not until your boundaries are pushed that you don't figure out what the skill is, the skill acquisition is for that particular level that you play at.
Yeah, and I think that critical inquiry skill that hopefully we all had been exposed to, I think, in our training, and the ability, whilst a lot of people are accessing information from that more networked social side of the internet, beautiful things exist, Google Scholar and databases, where if I have questions around my practice, I will go there, do a literature review, make some decisions, and find some truth as we know it at this point in time that fits and supports the people that I'm working with. And I feel like sometimes
PubMed's address hasn't changed.
And being a moderator of a big online clinical group, I also, that's a Google question, or there's some really fantastic foundational papers that explore that concept. And so it's a really interesting thing, I think, as clinicians, that potentially also a problem that we have is that we're not using those foundational skills that are research-based. And that doesn't mean you have to go into a PhD, but you can read a paper and critically analyze it, or critically analyze information,
sure,
and integrate that and translate that into a practice or a clinical practice in general. So I find I would like to see more confidence that's occurring as well. And again, there's some really wonderful education streams where that is taking place, but you have to choose to step into those and acknowledge that maybe you have a deficit there that needs to be expanded upon.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. And that kind of steps us into the final question, which is, if you could envision a future for the naturopathic profession, what would it look like? And I know, having spoken to you multiple times about the evidence base and the research arm of the profession, and how we get to dabble in it if we so choose. And I certainly am quite excited that my kid's just about to graduate high school, so I have all this wonderful, in my mind, spare time to do my PhD that I've been dabbling with every second year. Do that topic. You have mentioned that it would be amazing if the critical discernment and evidence base could be a springboard rather than a last resort. And what else could you see for the future of the naturopathic profession?
When we're looking at graduates, and I reflect on my experience as a graduate, whilst I'm very happy with where I've ended up over those years, there was uncertainty that I was just doing it alone and navigating and making choices, which is life. I get that. But at the same time, having a foundational group or program or pathway that was, you have choices, and explored what they could be. And also just to fall back and go, okay, this is okay. And so for us as a profession, that is having network, which again, social media provides to us in a certain capacity, and making those connections so that we're not navigating that alone, because you can still be a sole trader in online private practice, but you do need that framework or, hey, this is going on. This happened today. What does everyone think of this? I think that those are important things, and to have the trust really that it's all going to be okay, and you get to make the choices. They're your choices along the way. And you can, as a profession, as we've talked about, it has so much potential and propensity to be whatever you want it to be. They can merge the art and the science, and that can explore and come out of you in different ways at different seasons. And I just think that for our profession, which I think there's a lot of fear around us being obsolete, I really don't think that's a problem. When I talk to ChatGPT and it tells me some really stupid things, I'm like, I'm not going to do that. Sorry. But that is critical inquiry as well. Like, you have to know it's talking shit to know that it is making stuff up. I think that we've got a bright future ahead of us. It's certainly not my experience that people, even though we have access to so much technology in health, that people are weller. And there is a unfortunate entropy around health where people's health is declining because of our external pressures. And going back to really foundational naturopathic principles are important, because gosh, we do need sunshine and I do need rest and some water would be great. And I need to feed myself. The planet houseplant principles are really important for us. And if we have networks of people that can support us in that, we're going to be great. And then if we can continue to just provide that knowledge and that critical inquiry around what other information your clients are accessing as well. People need us and they still want us. And I'm not concerned on a business or personal perspective that I'm not going to have a job. I certainly, retirement is in my future, to which I look forward to embracing. But it's, yeah, I think we're in a really great position to continue to support people in a very stressed out world. And that potentially there will be a movement of disconnect for people, hopefully, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That was such a gold nugget for me, what you just said about it doesn't matter with how many evolutions we have of technology or how much access we have to technology, people's health is just still getting worse. And so there is still sicker people out there that we can help with something as simple as the houseplant philosophies, let alone the naturopathic philosophies. And if we can contribute to the body of evidence for all of those, as well as be present as a human to human in those interactions, we're never going to have to worry about losing our jobs.
Definitely not. And I don't know if your contribution to that body of evidence, it doesn't have to be a PhD. It's a clinical practice and being the best that you can be in that practice as well. And I think that's also important. Sometimes I meet people and it's a very uncomfortable for me, or that's my pathway. But I'm still a human and I'm still what I was before I had a PhD. And I don't think you need to feel insecure about not having done that pathway or not having done formal further education, because there's a richness of stuff that you can learn in general.
Body of evidence can come from being, you mentioned, in that network of being around other practitioners or being around a cohort of people who are colleagues and sharing an empirical situation or story of a client that you had that had a particular type of result based on their symptomology, their lifestyle, their story, and what you actually did to help. That's contributing to the body of evidence. As soon as you have that conversation, all of a sudden there's more to be said around those types of people and how we can help them even further. And that creates a ripple effect in and of itself, especially if that network is set up.
It sure does. And if you want to formalize that, publish a case study.
Yeah. Nudge, nudge. I love that. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation and everywhere we trailed with it today, Dr. Moira. It has been wonderful to chat. And if you would like more information around Dr. Moira's work, and especially in the intimate ecology space, or where you can find her next speaking, all of her details are available around this podcast. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.